This is a continuation of the first half of episode 8, also known as part 2 of 4, on the functions of the executive by Chester Bernard. If you are just tuning in, please go back and listen to the previous episode first. So another key thing in this theory of authority that he gives that we covered is that, you know, authority comes from communication. And actually, in section 2 of the chapter, which starts on page 175, he urges us to consider controlling factors in the character of the communication system as a system of objective authority, because for him, that is, you know, what authority is, as we discussed. And there are A, B, C, D, E, F, 6, 7, 5, some amount of these characteristics. And the first one is that he thinks it's important that for a system of communication to convey authority, for it to that the channels of communication are definitely known. So lines of authority must be definitely established. He goes on by saying that by assigning each individual to his position, by general announcements, by organizational charts, hierarchies and such, by securing as much permanence of a system as practicable. So I guess this translates into that people need to know where the orders are coming from, and they need to be on board with that, and they need to be okay, and they need to be able to identify the office that is issuing an order without any confusion. Interestingly, unlike Weber or even Taylor, who ascribe source of authority to the position, so you will recall that for Weber that was the office rather than the office holder, Bernard says it's either the position or the person, but usually both. So he does not shy away from identifying a person with an office and the other way around, which is quite practical, and I mean really how things work in empirically in organizations. You don't think of, all right, I need to go to executive office for, you know, regional logistics. You think I should go to John and get clearance from him or something like that. So that's quite again, coming back to this point that permeates our discussion, that for someone writing within the broad environment of scientific management, this is quite insightful and certainly down-to-earth, practically realistic.
I saw it more as a, like having communications that can be clearly identified in terms of who's responsible for them, putting a name to them, a face to them. So that's more what I saw in this.
Yeah, and that is feeding into point B, which is basically that everyone must report to someone, which is what you said, basically, that there needs to be identification with something real and actual, not just an abstract concept or a title or an office that may not even be occupied, which is a source of quite a lot of bureaucratic farce where you, I can't recall the book now, but I think it was something by Kafka that you need to deal with an office that doesn't have an office holder, and there is no way past that because of how the bureaucracy is set up. And in this point B, he makes a point of, he makes it clear that individuals in the organization must have a relationship to the organization, but not in a way that an abstraction of the organization, but actual people who are responsible for actual areas of cooperation. And there's a footnote here where he says that in some types of organizations, it is not unusual, however, for one person to report to and to be subordinate to two or three superiors, in which case the functions of the superiors are defined and are mutually exclusive in principle. So not contradicting his previous statement in those 4 points about when one would follow an order, that orders shouldn't contradict each other. In organizations such as matrix organizations, he kind of foresaw here, it's perfectly okay for an employee to have more than one superior. It's just the areas of responsibility of superiors should not overlap.
Yeah, I thought that it's a very interesting insight. It's interesting that he put it in a footnote. And I think it's also, you know, he's coming sort of in the abstract and in the more of the ideal world, because I've been in many circumstances where there's lots of overlap. and even if there were no overlap, you have the issue where you only have a single employee, so they can't do everything at one time. And that means there has to be a lot of cooperation between these different bosses, which is not always the case.
Right. So are you casting doubt on this claim then?
I am, because I think he's vastly simplifying what ends up happening, and even if there were, I'm saying, so I think it's unrealistic to think they wouldn't have overlapping responsibilities, because in complex organizations that does happen more often than you might think. And then second of all, this idea that they would all understand what the other person was telling the subordinate to do and coordinate amongst themselves is unrealistic, so unrealistic as to be almost comical.
Right, because at one point, at the very least, the person will have exceeded their ability to do things. That point four in the qualification of when to follow an order or not, that you mentioned, that a little impossible is still impossible. And then how do you know which order to disregard if they're all legitimate, but you're simply overstretched?
Right. And so sometimes it can be just as simple as saying, well, I've been assigned to do this, and here's my time frame. And I used to try to tell boss superiors when I had more than one, you know, try to, because they would sometimes say, so what are you doing? You know, and I would actually give them a long list of what I was doing and who I was, you know, doing it for. And then I had some people who wouldn't even ask. They would just say, well, you should go do this. And I said, well, where do I fit this in? You know, when I got a little bit more senior and experienced, I would find diplomatic ways to say, well, how do I fit this in with all these other things that I have going on? Some superiors don't make that easy to do.
And then you sort of inadvertently push the issue up towards the superiors, and then I guess they have to fight it out.
Sometimes, yes, and sometimes, so that absolutely happened, because I would get one superior to tell me to do something that was against the law. And I was having difficulty communicating that to them, because it wasn't an obvious, you know, don't turn left at a certain traffic intersection kind of physical law like that. It was more like a violation of spirit of contracts. And so the one superior wasn't accepting that. And I said, well, then you're going to have to talk to this other guy for whom I work, and I'm responsible for that function, you know, of what I do. And so that was that gets very difficult sometimes. That's why I'm thinking it's interesting that he covered it, but it's so simplified it's almost not to be meaningful.
I'm glad you provided these examples, because it kind of does make sense when you read about it in abstract. That there are definite areas of responsibility that different superiors have, and as long as they don't overlap, that's okay. But sure, that doesn't quite work out this way in reality, or, you know, in practical work anyway.
No.
And this feeds into the point C, where he makes an observation that lines of communication should be as short as possible, because he has limited trust in how people use language. Possibly not as much of an issue again nowadays because of technology, the information communication technology, but I broadly agree with him still. He says that if a communication needs to pass through a number of relays, it's likely to be corrupted, misinterpreted, and misrepresented. So the shorter the line of communication, and one can think of it as a literal line, the better.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, and that's often lost on people. I would say the corollary to that is that you can have longer lines of communication, but you must dramatically simplify the message. So the practical way I would say it is for complex information or complex communication, you must have a very short line of communication. For more general, kind of big picture, strategic kind of things, you can have a longer line of communication. So the line really depends on the complexity of the communication that you're trying to have. He doesn't go into that level of detail, but I imagine that's what he's trying to convey.
He does make an interesting addition to this, saying that his point is supported by the fact that even huge and complex organizations have about the same number of levels in the this process of passing communication as small ones. That seemed incorrect. How does your experience support this?
Yeah, I think that's based on his personal experience at the time. You don't see that. You know, most smaller organizations, you see maybe two or three levels of hierarchy. They tend to be very flat. And it's in the bigger, more industrialized, more bureaucratic organizations where you have these multiple layers and you know, many different reporting chains and those, you know, those kinds of things. So that has not been my experience in the informal organizations that I've been in. And in fact, one of the things you see in the Navy is that that the people who serve on submarines who have it's a very flat organization, and everybody knows everybody on a submarine because you're not very far from them. And so when they get assigned to an aircraft carrier or something larger, it's nearly incomprehensible to them, you know, how this large organization can function. And they're actually a bit dispirited because they don't know everybody as well, and the lines of communication are quite a bit longer, and things get much more complicated. And it's interesting. They have this kind of culture shock when they come to a larger organization because it's so different than what they've seen in their smaller organization.
I think if there's one thing that strikes me about all this discussion on communication is that the general line of reasoning is, as we said before, quite unrealistic. Like, in principle, the good principles, that's okay, I can agree that this is how things should work, but reality is quite different. So this idea of not skipping any step of the line, of going through all the levels, of having... of also respecting the same way that communications flow throughout the organization. I'm sure that there are 1,001 exceptions to which things don't work like that. And I think it's a missed opportunity within this part of the work.
Yeah, so I think his theory is very general here. Absolutely, Miranda. I have the same general concern, so of course I'm quibbling with some of the details. But I think the theory is pretty good. It's just that when you get into very specific circumstances, it has to be adapted. Because the example I would give is you generally do not want to skip levels of the hierarchy, but you can't depend on them for getting your message transmitted, particularly if it's a complicated one. So there's a lot of style and creativity involved in how do you do that? How do you keep people informed such that they don't overrule you or don't give conflicting orders to subordinates, you know, those kinds of things when you got more than one boss. So he could have made this almost a whole book. I mean, this whole part of the, I know that's not quite what he was doing, but it would have been, it does feel a little bit unsatisfying that he doesn't go to that level of detail.
And also we need to consider that within this conception that he provides here, this hypothetical organization is extremely narrow because information doesn't just go vertically. Much of the time it goes horizontally, and not all information that travels vertically necessarily travels horizontally as well. This is something that he doesn't consider at all. So he gives an example of the Catholic Church as a paragon of shortness of the line of communication. But okay, Catholic Church doesn't deal with overly complex work. It's very spread out horizontally, and it's almost a clustered organization in very many ways. So there isn't much going on in terms of complexity of giving orders or dealing with the environment and that sort of thing. I mean, I may be completely off, but I think the bigger issue there is horizontal dissemination of information where it goes on the same level from different units one to another.
I mean, it's also true that I think the idea that he has of organizations, especially given the continuous reference to the Catholic Church, is of an organization that is pretty stable over time. So if you take the church with some exceptions, the message that has the key pieces of information, the core central ones, are kind of like the same ones. But with organizations, I think their mission could change over time and a lot of things could change. So communication has to be more flexible.
Especially when he openly acknowledges that different units may have different purposes. And if we kind of import Weber here from episode 6, different offices hold different entitlements to different types of information. So even by this line of reasoning, on a vertical level, sorry, on a horizontal level, not everyone will benefit from the same type of information. In fact, they don't even need it. That may not be the function of their office, or it may not be the function or the purpose of the unit to necessarily pass down information from top to bottom if it is of no concern to their particular area of work.
Yeah, I think the issue is, I believe he's correct, and the issue, it just becomes down to about some things, right? So there's where sort of the creativity and art of organizations comes to bear. And I think you covered that very well, Demetrius, about, you know, what do you communicate, you know, down, and what has to go to each level. And I think I wish Bernard had gone in a little bit more detail about that, because he's discussing it at a very high level. And I don't think it makes him wrong. I just think there's a lot more detail involved to really understand how to apply that.
Okay. Building up on that, the next point is that the competence of the persons serving as communication centers, those officers, supervisory heads, must be adequate. So I understand this is that they need to be competent and qualified not only to do their jobs, but also to deal with communication. And he says that this also involves being cognizant of what technology is being used to facilitate communication, which is probably more apt nowadays than it was in Bernard's time. And this point, I think, is certainly worthwhile.
Yeah, I can think of lots of not exactly counterexamples, but examples of where that doesn't go well. You know, people don't have that kind of competence, and it causes all sorts of problems. So I absolutely think it's a key point. The example I could give you is you struggle in engineering technical firms, and so the Navy's one, but I've been in other firms where it's similar, or organizations where it's similar, where you get people who have great expertise at the technical details on what you might call the front line or the kind of problem areas that they work in, and then you need managers, and these people will get promoted to managers, and they're very ineffective as managers because they do not understand, even though they understand the technical details of the work, they do not understand how to communicate effectively and what people need to know. And so I think it's a truism to say, oh yeah, you want to have people confident in their jobs about communicating, but I think we don't. We often in the United States and many organizations, and you see this in literature, we emphasize, oh, it's very important to communicate and you have to communicate effectively, but nobody ever learns how to do that very well. And so you see all sorts of difficulties in the communication system because of that. And so I think it's a very important point. And, you know, you could write a book just about that kind of stuff, about saying, well, you know, how do you ever promote people to positions of higher responsibility if they're supposed to be competent from day one? Because nobody is in a new job, or particularly if their responsibilities and their duties have changed. So it's a good point. It's important because a lot of organizations don't pay a lot of attention to it. It's about how it affects the communication system.
Well, that book has been written. It's called The Peter Principle by Raymond Hull.
I knew you were going to bring that up. That's great. I just didn't want to be the first guy.
Well, you served it on a silver platter.
Great.
And Peter Principle is basically that in organizations, every employee will rise or get promoted to his or her level of incompetence. And that certainly may have to do with communication skills, which are, we know, not only from Bernard, are key to management. What I wanted to ask you is, all of us, myself, Miranda, and Pedro, who's looking for shelter on the streets of New York, presumably, we all arrived at the workplace when email was well established, but you have been there before. So,
yes, it makes me a dinosaur, but yes,
a dinosaur,
I did.
Dinosaur, an elder, perhaps.
Oh, thank you.
So, my question is this. So, when email was being introduced into the workplace for you. Clearly, it wasn't a uniform process. So have you had experiences where this line of communication would not necessarily break down, but sort of stumble once it reached the person who did not know how to use email, or conversely, when the communication was still note-based and paper-based, but email was kind of being introduced here and there?
Yes, so I can give you some examples. Yes, I saw that several times. I went to graduate school at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, where they had a very sophisticated email system, and were on the university side of the internet when it was widely available inside universities. And I learned about email. It really wasn't used a lot for classes and classwork like it is now, but I learned about those kinds of communication tools. And then I went back to my Navy jobs and where there was nothing like it. We had nothing like that. And it was all word of mouth and written reports and a lot of handwriting stuff. And so I would encounter a few people as email was getting introduced in subsequent organizations that didn't, you would see two things. One is people would be communicating inappropriately in email. And I'm not talking about, vulgarity or, those kind of problems, but they would be communicating a really complex issue in email when you really couldn't be sure people were reading it and what the other people were doing with it. And so I went to my boss and I said, hey, there needs to be and so I would get an email from this person and it said, you have action in the following attachment. So I look up the attachment. I couldn't understand what my action was supposed to be because I had just come to the organization. I would go back to the person who issued the email and I would say, I don't understand what I'm supposed to do. Can you explain this to me? And they would basically say, I would get a response. I'm just a functionary. I'm not responsible for this. I don't know what's inside. And so I'm thinking, how can you submit emails like this? And I went to my superior, the CEO of the organization. I said, this is not sustainable, because we're doing stuff in email that's not effective, and yet someone's crossing off their list and saying, yep, I issued the email. And so now I said, you can't function that way. And I said, we have to kind of integrate this stuff into the meetings and the face-to-face stuff that we do. And I must've been talking, Esperanto to him, because he could not understand. His view was, well, I can stay up till 9 o'clock at night processing my email, so I don't have a problem. And I was trying to explain to him, it's not you who's the problem. You're not the problem. It's the other people I'm having problems. We're having problems with. I just couldn't get that across to him. And so, yeah, you kind of see it all the time. In fact, I went kind of an interesting incident. I was communicating with this was back in the days before it was easy to that all email by default would include a copy of the original message, right? So you'd often get people responding to you, but there would be no copy of the original message, and you couldn't tell what they were answering. And I guess they assumed it was you only got one email a day, and so it was obvious what they were communicating to. And so I'd have to go back to people and say, what are you agreeing to? Or what are you disagreeing with? I can't tell, because they wouldn't even quote the original email. So what I learned at MIT was, because they had that built in, I learned to actually excerpt the parts of the email I wanted to comment on, and then put those in the email with the right brackets or right arrows. I guess that's what that key is called. And then I would comment on it and say, okay, here's what I'm doing, or here's what I'm doing about that, or whatever. And so one of my bosses, one of these multiple overlapping superiors or non-overlapping superiors I had, had his secretary call me and said, he wants to know, how do you do that? What program are you using to do that? And I said, well, because it's not built in our system, I'm doing it manually. And of course, he wasn't interested anymore after he found out, because he found out he had to do this by hand. But I thought it was an essential way to communicate with people. So yeah, I saw all sorts of problems. And even today, so now let's fast forward to today. And I see people in organizations and ones I've been in trying to do stuff in email that's completely inappropriate for email. And once again, not because of they're using bad language, but it's because you can't communicate it the kind of subtlety and sophistication you need to do in email. It just, you have to get together with a few people. And I'm not a big fan of meetings all the time, but I would say, call me on the phone. I can't answer this because it's a very complicated issue. It'd be like trying to do this podcast via email, discussion group. You could do some things, but we couldn't reflect off each other. Oh, yeah, exactly. For weak Skype. So, yes, I have lots of experience with how it goes well and poorly.
You know, the thing with the phone calling, I still observed that in my last field work on architecture. They still do that because the issues that are being communicated through design drawings and various technical information are complex and really need context, or at least some kind of a pointer in order to be digested properly. They would normally pick up the phone and call the person sending an email, not to an effect of, you know, what is this, but sort of, I got it, okay, what next? So it's certainly still there.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people who grew up with email and text messages and that thing don't often see the difference, or you know, don't recognize the difference until they get in more complex organizations. And I've spent much time teaching people. You know, I'd send them a note saying, "Okay, please call me on this," and try to do it in a way that's, you know, and then I put in parentheses, "You're not in trouble," you know, but just which by the way can be misinterpreted email. It looks like you're in trouble when someone sends you an email like that. And then we'd have a 15-minute conversation, and I'd say at the end, I'd say, "All right, what we just did, that's about 6 pages of email, what we just talked about. And it's just not a good use of either one of our time to do that." And they'd say, "Oh, yeah." So I was trying to coach them on, here's the kinds of issues you really want to talk to somebody on the phone about. And I still get people sending emails. So this may or may not fit your example, but I think it's worth talking about communication. They'll send you an email and say, "Oh, so give me a call. And, you know, sometime." And they don't give you a time and date or tell you when they're available. So that leaves you to guess. And I know these are very busy people. And so, you know, okay, sure, I'll call them. And of course, I get voicemail or they're not available. And so I'll send back a note saying, "Well, I called. Tell me. So here's when I'm available. When does that fit for you?" And I still see people today, you know, even the complex lives we lead, saying, "Oh, yeah, just give me a call." That's almost never appropriate because people are so busy.
That is striking such a nerve for me, because I'm dealing with with the same thing. Now I'm scheduling some interviews for this NHS thing that I'm tangentially working on, and I just got, you know, sent an email like, "Yeah, I'd like to speak to you about this and that. Can we schedule a meeting?" And I get a response saying that I'm getting quite a few emails right now, so call me please. And as you just pointed out, I went through the same type of thing where I call, I hit voicemail or just nothing, and then I have to send an email saying that I called, so this is when perhaps we should reschedule, and it's just, this goes right over and over right and over again.
So the people I mentor, I tell them, look, never ask to, you know, for me to call you without telling me when you're available, because you're make me send an extra email. It's going to be an extra email back and forth to figure that out. So anytime you say you want to do that, and there's people, so my age and just a bit younger, they just don't get that. I guess they just feel like that they've done their job or their due diligence when they say call me. And the younger people, they do tend to get, because so one of the most challenging things you see in communication emails, when you have to set up a meeting and someone says, like your boss says, "Well, set up this meeting with these 5 other extremely senior and very busy executives. I want those guys all in a room at one time or on a phone." Oh my gosh. You know, that's hard to do, but there's actually a process you go through for doing that. That's not written down anywhere, and it can be done. And I won't go over in the podcast,
write a blog post.
We don't teach anybody, you know, those kinds of things. Yeah, exactly. We could do a separate podcast just on that. That's
exciting. Yes. And then there's the consideration that, hey, the reason I'm writing you an email in the first place is maybe because I don't want to call you. Cold calling is such a
some people do
unpleasant
that
activity, you know, to begin with. But maybe that's just me.
Yeah, in fact, it's my preference never to do that. Even if I'm going to call somebody, if I'm going to cold call them, I'll still send them an email in the hope that they'll read it and see, oh, here's what he wants to talk about. Because it's a sort of a different approach to communications, to give somebody a little bit of advance idea of what you're going to talk about. So yeah, that's a big challenge in our, you know, electronic world.
Okay, with that out of the way, us ranting about email and things, let's get back to Barnard. I think point F about line of communication not being interrupted, we covered. So we can skip that. Also, I don't really understand what he's talking about there. And the final one is that every communication should be authenticated. And I think we covered that with the whole letterhead discussion, unless you want to add anything.
No, so I would add one about the not being interrupted one. I think what he's talking about is, you know, you if you're trying to communicate something, you try not to make it start and stop and do it, you know, basically say, okay, here's, you know, part of the story and I'll tell you more of it, you know, later, that kind of thing. So I think it's more about trying to keep the flow continuous, because if you get certain kind of things that are hard to communicate in short bursts, because context is very important. And sometimes people are, one of the things I think you have to pay attention to is if somebody, maybe it's a corollary, not directly this part about the interruption, but somebody's really busy, and got a lot of stuff going on, and you're trying to communicate something complicated to them, you might as well not bother. Or you have to be very concerned they wouldn't get it all because they're not really paying attention to you. So whether it's interrupted because of divided attention or time and space considerations, I think that's what he's talking about.
I think I understood that the entire communication package should be unique. So I was also thinking, what if there's a communication which is incomplete because pieces of information will arrive later on? So I got the idea that you should wait for the entire package to be available. The thing is that there are some communications that have pieces of information that will follow up.
Yeah, I think that completeness is very important. And it's not always obvious when you're composing the communication because you get all the stuff up in your head. You understand it really well. And I find it's a common weakness that people have is that they don't kind of look at it from the other person's perspective and say, oh, here's this, you know, here's what somebody brand new to this would need to know.
This is why I really like Google Docs and other such platforms where you collaborate in real time with multiple colleagues. This way you don't necessarily have to go through sequential and chronological communication that is normally one way.
Yeah, I think that's sort of I don't want to say necessarily generational, but it's sort of an age thing, because I try to go to people my age and get them to use Google Docs, and they just don't know what I'm talking about. And forget about, they don't understand, they don't know how to use the program itself or the web interface. It's, they don't even understand why it would be useful. And I try to tell them, look, if we have 15 revisions or 15 people involved making revisions, it's driving me nuts going back and forth doing some people changes. And Google Docs is a much better way to do that. They just don't quite get that, you know, you get above a certain level of complexity of communication or coordination or cooperative system. And then these kinds of tools are wonderful for being able to coordinate. And so I think that's a challenge in maintaining cooperative systems.
It's not just the age thing. I'm facing similar challenges with my immediate peers.
Okay. So it's not just, so they don't get the whole idea of it. And so then when you try to say, well, here's how it, you know, enables cooperation better, it's like they just don't understand you, because I think the issue is you can communicate all you want. They just don't see why they should go to that level of complexity. And yet that's one of the challenges with communication tools, right? Is you want to pick the right medium for the level that's suited to the level of complexity. That's kind of what we were talking about earlier, whether it's, you know, email or meeting or phone call or those kinds of things. And you see people making that mistake all the time in organizations, kind of picking an inappropriate or ineffective means. And it makes things very complicated and actually leads to lots of misunderstandings, like Miranda was talking about.
Yeah. Well, we're writing a journal article with Pedro, and I cannot get him to use Google Docs. So we have to send back and forth the Microsoft Word document with the track changes, which are incredibly inconvenient for my money.
Yes.
So yes, there of course. You go. And Pedro is only a year older than I am.
Okay. So it's a challenge.
Yes. all right. I think that might be it for chapter on authority.
So I have one.
Shall we move on to?
I have one final summary comment about the chapter before we leave it. And the last, you know, final pages, Bernard says, authority is another name for the willingness and capacity of individuals to submit to the necessities of cooperative systems. That is just an amazing sentence, and so we don't have to spend a whole lot of time because we've already discussed it, but I just love the way that kind of sums up his view of authority, that it's willingness and capacity of the individual, because it really brings this extra dimension to the concept of the term authority that you don't usually see.
Right, it somehow disembodies authority from the executives and simultaneously introduces this bottom-up thing into it, that you do not submit to authority of a particular individual, but rather to the necessity of the system, and you still get to choose whether you submit or not at all. So that's a very interesting...
Yeah, I think that's a profound insight.
It is. Simultaneously, yeah. It's not reflective of the human experience, though, I think, because I think Miranda mentioned that. I think Miranda talked about this in our episode on Weber, that you still get orders from people and you have to order people around. So even as much as one can assume the persona of the system of cooperation when issuing directives and orders, this is not how it is operationalized. There's always an individual, unless it's some kind of a dystopian or Wizard of Oz type of situation.
And I agree, but I think they're compatible in that what you're talking about is sort of this overlay of what goes on, you know, what people like and kind of how they conceptualize authority. And I think underneath that Bernard is talking about what goes on underneath is actually perhaps more realistic. So I think that they're both going on.
Oh, certainly, certainly. I'm not dismissing it. I'm just saying that unless we live in a brave new world, there is always going to be an egocentric experience to any kind of organization.
So what did you think about the last sentence of the chapter? The status of authority in a society is the measure both of the development of individuals and of the technological and social conditions. Because I found it quite strange, this idea of giving further legitimation to authority by invoking the development of an individual, but also of technology and of society in general.
Isn't this following up on what we've just been talking with Ralph about? That perhaps what he's trying to say is that the more people in a society can abstract away from their individual selves towards a system of cooperation, a cooperative system, the more sort of developed such a society is. Is that what he's saying?
But what about technology? How did you fit this in the entire discussion? Because I'm quite perplexed by this point.
Right. I think it has to do with technology of communication, and on the one hand, so it's one of these terms that he kind of uses at one point very specifically and at a different point very loosely and colloquially. So I think there are two things here. One is the technology in a way of communication, which is crucial to authority. And another technology in a way of mediating the limitations of both the body and the environment. So I'm inclined to think it's more of the former here, because he's talking about authority. So the tighter or sort of more effective the authority is, this reflects the degree to which technology is facilitating communication. I would read it that way, I think.
That's what it looked like to me, that he was talking about the former aspect.
Social conditions, I'm not sure what that refers to. Have we had a discussion on the social conditions? Did we do this in part episode 7?
Yeah, I think he's talking about hierarchy in the organization and the how people interpret the how they interpret communications.
Specialization.
All right, we had in part 1, so part 1 of the book, which is part 1 of episode 7. We had chapter on psychological and social factors in systems of cooperation. I think maybe he's referring to that. And as I recall, social factors had to do with eliciting others to invest their energy for the purposes of producing material outcomes. So technology then here would mean, I guess we need to translate this sentence again. So the status of authority, which is submitting to official communication in a society, is the measure both of the development of individuals, so that presumably is means what it means, face value, and of the technological, which we presume has to do with the facilitation of communication, and social conditions of society. So social conditions here would then imply, I think, a degree to which people are successful at producing stuff, so productivity, possibly. And then the sentence would mean that the degree of, because he talks about the status of authority, so then the degree to which authority is heeded to is a function of medium of communication and productivity.
And social conditions, I would say.
Well, the social conditions is the productivity, though.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
I don't feel that this made it clear.
Makes more sense. Well, I don't know. I was a bit confused with technology. I was thinking of other things. That's why it didn't make sense to me. But if you ground technology in the idea of communication and the idea of authority, it's more, it makes more sense.
I mean, he may mean technology as technology and social as social. It's hard to tell when he's kind of hedging some very specific, very technical terms in the way that he is, but not using them consistently. He could have capitalized, I suppose.
Yeah, he makes these kind of sweeping. Yeah, he makes these kind of sweeping statements, and I'm like Miranda. Sometimes I'm going to scratch my head saying, "Well, what did he mean by that?" Because it doesn't. It sometimes doesn't make it clearer for me. But that, you know, it's a kind of a quibble with the way he writes.
Okay, shall we move on to chapter 13?
Yes.
Okay.
The environment of decision, where he talks about the decision-making process, which I summarized as having the following characteristics. So, it is the matter of discriminating important strategic factors from unimportant ones, redefining or changing the organization's purpose on the basis of an estimate of future results of action in the existing situation. So, protension, predicting stuff. And this is done in light of history, experience, or knowledge of the past. So I'm inclined to read this as organizational memory, but that's only because that's what I do. And
so I think you can go there.
I suppose so. Although I would need to. I think we'd need to go into the text to see the history, experience, and knowledge of the past of what? Is it the organization or the broader environment somehow?
Yeah, and I think he means both the organization and the broader environment, because he talks in other places about perspective and the strategic, you know, view of the purpose of the organization. So I think you could say that would be both.
Right. But before we go there, decision-making process is conducted in two phases. So phase one has to do with personal decisions, which are decisions by the individuals affected whether or not to contribute to in his terminology, a cooperative effort, so the organization, whether you want to or not. You can't delegate these decisions, and they are external to the organization, because if you recall, personality disappears into the phase of cooperation the moment individuals join the cooperative system, i.e. the organization. And the second phase is impersonal decisions, which is a response made by individuals whose role and intent is to affect the organizational system as a whole. So these can be delegated, and they are internal to the organization. The implication of this is that the responsibility for organizational decision-making is assigned both positively and definitely to those located at the organization's communication centers, tying it to our discussion of authority. And this basically means that the aptness of a decision depends upon those who possess the knowledge of facts and of organizational purpose, of course.
I think it's interesting that the whole chapter kind of emphasizes the social nature of organizational decisions. He mentions that a few times. And I thought that was a pretty important insight. And I also like your emphasis or distinguishing, referencing Bernard's distinguishing between personal and what I called organizational decisions. That's what he calls them on page 188, because this idea that you can delegate one, but you can't delegate the other. I thought that was very interesting. And then one other part, you talked about the executives making the decisions, and he emphasizes that kind of decision making is a specialization of process. That's a role, or that's a specialization. That's the essence of the function they perform in the organization.
I also liked. I think my favorite quote is already in italics. It's at 194. The fine art of executive decision consists in not deciding questions that are not now pertinent, in not deciding prematurely, in not making decisions that cannot be made effective, and in not making decisions that others should make. So also this idea that decisions are like not deciding, and I found it quite funny.
Oh, I thought that was great. I had the same thing written down.
Do you want to read the remainder of this paragraph?
Oh, it's a great paragraph.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah. So not to decide questions that are not pertinent at the time is uncommon good sense, though to raise them may be uncommon perspicacity. Not to decide questions prematurely is to refuse commitment of attitude or the development of prejudice. Not to make decisions that cannot be made effective is to refrain from destroying authority. Not to make decisions that others should make is to preserve morale, to develop competence, to fix responsibility, and to preserve authority.
Yeah, that's a great paragraph.
And then he makes a distinction between positive and negative decisions. Positive. And this is excellent. A negative decision, I love that. So positive decisions are decisions as we are familiar with them, that, do this, that.
Yeah, I agree.
Or stop doing something. But negative decisions are decisions not to decide. So that's great. He qualifies non-decision as a type of decision. Because I think this emphasizes the characteristic that even a lack of decision is a type of decision. I mean, if you think about his Aristotelian roots, and he was talking about something broadly like teleology in the beginning of the book, then this is totally compatible with that. Evading consciously or unconsciously a decision still has an impact on activity, within the organization.
Right, and in fact, I agree with him. Essences of executive decision making is deciding that it's not, you don't need to make a decision now. And I will tell you, as you get more senior in organizations, it is difficult to do, because you have all this power and authority. And you have to realize this isn't the best time to make that decision, or we don't need to make that decision right now. And that is not a skill easily learned.
Or it's not my decision, which is quite fascinating.
Yeah, you see that all the time too.
And this, in effect, then assigns or kind of qualifies every single person, every single phase of cooperation within the organization with effectively a decision-making responsibility. Because anytime one says that I make no decisions here, that is still a decision that is being made. It still has an effect on the organization.
Right, and he actually talks earlier about the acceptance of authority. That's a decision. You're deciding, whether you're going to do what the person in authority has said. And so I think it's fallacious for people in organizations to say, I don't make any decisions here. Maybe not certain kinds of decisions, but they make plenty. I thought was also interesting in this chapter, page 199, he talks about some kind of high level, but he talks about the organizational decision making, differs among types of organizations. Didn't go into as much detail as I would like to have him done that, but you do see that in the modern world, where somebody, they'll retire from the military, where they're used to having lots of authority and lots of people carrying out their orders, and then they go into either politics or education, perhaps university setting, and they're not very effective because they find they can't just issue orders directly. In fact, there's this famous quote when Harry S. Truman was the outgoing president of the United States and Dwight D. Eisenhower, the World War II general, was coming in. And Truman said, poor Ike, because, you know, Truman had spent his life in politics. And the first, I think, elected office Dwight D. Eisenhower held was a presidency. And Truman said, is reported to have said, poor Ike, he's just going to, you know, give all these orders and nothing's going to happen. because the decision making in government is much different, right? And so you, because I'm here in Australia, New Zealand for the last few weeks, it's very hard to have a conversation with somebody without them asking me what I think about Donald Trump. And because people over here are aghast at what's going on. And I tell them, I said, well, it's an interesting experiment. We're going to find out if somebody who's skilled at making certain kinds of business decisions would also be skilled as the leader of a country. I said, that's kind of an open question. I don't know how that's going to work out.
Yes. Obama keeps reiterating that being a president is a serious kind of a job with serious kinds of decisions.
So it's interesting, but I think people get disappointed when I say that because they're looking for me to say something bad about Trump. And so you can see it's not quite the answer they're looking for.
Yeah. I don't think we should go that much more, but it is quite entertaining.
No, I don't want to. Enough about that. I just thought it was an interesting application.
It was more to stop myself because
I'm done.
It's a great source of entertainment for me to not only watch what Trump says, but also watch things like SNL and Tonight Show parodying him.
Yeah, yeah. It's actually the reactions I find more interesting than what he says.
Yeah. Right. The theory of opportunism. Theory of opportunism. Very different.
Yeah. So of course, me being the social scientist I am, I love the sentence. And I think it's on that first page of the chapter. In the case of organizations, however, all ends of actions are arrived at by social processes. I love that. I said, oh, this is okay. I'm going to love this chapter.
Right. But what other choice is there, really? I know it's an obvious question, but
you'd be surprised. A lot of people think it's a very positivist world out there, and just give actions and off you go. And it's the social part is so engineers, who are taught to think of the world in sort of abstract technical terms, they struggle with that actually, because you see a lot of times engineers are trying to engineer people out of the system, and it never seems to work very well.
I mean, of course, not disregarding technological determinism and stuff like that. In a more loose way, engineers are still people. So the engineering of the boundaries that is still done by socially.
Well, I agree, but see, I think that's one of the things that makes technology, one thing that can make technology hard for people, and I hope this isn't too big a digression, but I'll keep it short, and that is that if you're using something like a smartphone or some such device, you have to understand the technical model the engineer designer used to design the system, because if you don't kind of grasp that model or attempt to define it, usually it's not communicated, so you'll try to figure it out. If you don't grasp that model, then every interaction you have is like magic, because you don't understand the consequences of what you're doing, and it's hard for you to interpret the feedback. And so I have many associates and friends who are very social, and they want to bend the technology to their will, as if they can make a telephone do what they wanted to do, or make a call without having to press the numbers. And I try to explain to them, you have to understand what the model of the tool is, and they just reject that. And I said, well, then you're going to be very unhappy using this technology, because it's not going to work the way you want to. I just find that interesting that they don't accept. So there's this social technical interface for modern technology that's very hard for people. So I kind of went off in a direction there, but I couldn't resist.
I think it needed to be said. I guess let's start maybe with a summary. I don't really have much to say about this chapter. Basically, Barnard views... first of all, opportunism is a type of decision, and it begins with an existing purpose and an environment within which people exist. So the physical factors, coming back to the beginning of the book, biological, social, emotional, moral, and the ideal process of decision, this is on page 209, is to discriminate the strategic factors and to redefine or change purpose on the basis of the estimate of future results of action in the existing situation in the light of history, experience, knowledge of the past. So the things that I hope designate memory, organizational memory. I think it's worth to remind what organizational purpose is, and it is the impersonal reason for which formal organization exists. We covered that in episode 7 quite a lot. And the strategic factor that is alluded to here is something like a limitation that, when controlled in the right form, at the right place and at the right time, coming back to the whole temporal-spatial thing that was in the beginning of part 3. So that limitation that will establish a new system or set of conditions which meets the organizational purpose. So that is the crux of the opportunistic aspect of making decisions. It's about taking the existing purpose, taking the environment within which this purpose transpires, and figuring out which strategic factors need to be included and excluded in light of what you want to achieve, so future purpose, and in light of what you tried previously, that's the past, in order to basically make this kind of a decision. I think that's about it on this matter. Or did I miss anything?
I think you had all the highlights. One thing I thought was interesting about this, especially interesting in this chapter, beyond what you noted, which I think was a good summary, is that he has a comment or line on page 201 where he says, "It is impossible by definition that formal organizations can act without the moral element. It is indispensable to them." And he goes on to some further detail in the chapter talking about the moral element, because it gets very abstract and a little bit hard to follow. But I just thought that was very... and he says, I think someplace else he says, "The moral element of organization action concerns how the actions relate to accomplishing the purpose of the organization." So that's why I think your comment of bringing back up the purpose was useful.
And that's all for the first half of episode 8. Thank you for listening. Please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com for information on what is to follow, future episodes, and our blog. If you're enjoying our discussion of Bernard thus far, please leave us a positive review on iTunes, subscribe to our feed, and tell your friends and colleagues about this podcast. You can also get in touch with us on our website, Twitter, Facebook, and on LinkedIn. Thank you, and we hope to see you next week as we conclude our discussion of the functions of the executive here on Talking About Organizations.